If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
There's no question in my view that had the war not stopped and had he carried on, you would have a situation in Europe where there was not one. And that is if you think of it, that is a truly extraordinary thing.
That was Lawrence Rees talking about the Nazis' desire to eliminate the Jews of Europe.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our interview this week is with Lawrence Rees, an author, historian, and award-winning filmmaker, whose documentary series include The Nazis, A Warning from History, and Auschwitz, The Nazis and the Final Solution. He is the author of a new book entitled The Holocaust, A New History, which tells the story of the Nazis' plan to exterminate the Jews, and is based in part on Lawrence's own interviews with both the victims and perpetrators. I paid a visit to Lawrence in his London home not long ago to discuss some of the issues that the book raises. First of all, prior to the Holocaust, anti-Semitism seemed to be far more prevalent in many countries other than Germany. So why do you think it was Germany in particular that instigated the Holocaust?
That's a huge question. I mean, that's the kind of thing that universities have week-long seminar courses on to try and answer. So it's very difficult to be definite in one relatively brief answer. But as you say, what's important, first of all, to remember is that if you looked, for example, at what was happening in Russia prior to the First World War, there's many, many more instances of violent attacks on Jews in Russia than there ever were in Germany. The anti-Semitism in Russia was of a different violent order. So if, as I say in the book, if you were asked, if you'd been around the early years of the 20th century and you'd been asked to predict where this would happen, I think it's very, very unlikely that you would ever have said Germany. You would probably have said Russia. So, as you say, there's a huge question, which is why did it happen here in Germany? Why was it instigated from Germany? And I think there a number of things came together. The most important was the circumstances of the loss of the First World War, because what that did was create an environment in which you had a huge feeling of looking for someone to blame for what had happened. There was a huge amount of scapegoating going on, a sense that famously, quote, we'd been stabbed in the back by the Jews, that they had been the ones responsible for the defeat. It was nonsense, of course, but there was a real sense of wanting to believe that what had happened was someone else's fault. And then you had that, at the same time, you had the rise of communism in Russia, the revolution of 1917, and that spilled over in the early years immediately after the First World War into a number of uprisings in Germany, the Spartacus Revolt and the Räter Republik in Bavaria, and Jews were involved in that. So there became this conflation that Judaism equals Bolshevism. And so the combination of all that, a fear of communism, a humiliation at the end of the war, a sense of looking for someone to blame, a sense that things had gone wrong in the whole nature of Germany, plus the removal of the monarchy, the imposition, as some felt, of the Weimar Republic, which again was associated with Jews. Again, all of these things are forced to a large degree and fantasies to a large degree, but nonetheless, many people believe them. So they felt that there was a sense in which the whole of these institutions were now Jew-dominated as they saw it. And so something needed to be done. And that something that needed to be done, a whole load of Volkisch groups by that one means nationalistic groups that wanted to put the German people first, the German people meaning an exclusion of Jews, but as they saw it, the Aryan people, they would be put first, and that what should happen is something should be done about the less than 1% of Germans who were Jews, who were kind of responsible for the horrors that people were going through. Now, that wasn't the Holocaust. That doesn't mean that everybody thought, well, we're going to try and exterminate Jews or whatever, but there was a sense in these national groups, like the Nazis in the early years of the 1920s, that something needed to be done. And the person who was most espousing the need for something to be done in the most vitriolic way from the very beginning was Adolf Hitler.
Obviously, we know Hitler and the Nazis were an incredibly anti-Semitic movement. How far did that chime with the rest of the German population? And to what extent was that, did that help or hinder their advance to power?
Very, very important point, because this notion that somehow Germany was this uniquely anti-Semitic place, that the enormous numbers of Germans at this stage wanted something horrific to happen to the Jewish minority in the country, isn't true. The majority of Germans didn't support the Nazis. In fact, in 1928, the general election of 1928, the Nazis got 2.6% of the vote. So this notion that there was this huge upswell at that point for all of this simply isn't the case. These are people on the fringes. And many people thought at that stage, they're on the lunatic fringe.
Was there ever a long-term Nazi plan or long-term plan from Hitler to exterminate the Jews? Or did it kind of come along incrementally?
Certainly, I think if you read the book and you study the evidence, I don't believe that you could possibly say that in the early 1920s, Hitler had some kind of blueprint that he was going to follow to do what became the death camps of the East. I don't believe that. So no, but how I look at it is that certainly if you read Mein Kampf, which Hitler wrote in 1924, it exudes a level of virtually psychopathic hatred about Jews. This is a man who has major problems. This is a man who's got major anger. This is a man who has worked out in his mind that something needs to be done about these people. Now, did he mean by that, I want to kill them all, exterminate, that we can't know what's in the dark, very dark depths of his mind. But what I do think is that he felt absolutely something needs to be done. And at that stage, the policy of the Nazi Party was clear. What that something was removing citizenship from these people, from Jews, and probably over time, expulsion. But that was the kind of direction that they were drifting. In terms of what actually happened, that actually happened due to a whole series of circumstances and Hitler's reaction to those circumstances and a whole variety of different influences. But at the core of it was always Hitler. The core of it was Hitler's desire to do something, as he saw it, about what he called the Jewish problem. So absolutely, I'm with the great Sri and Kershaw on this in thinking no Hitler, no Holocaust. But did he have a detailed plan back in the 20s for this? I simply can't see the evidence of that.
And there was something you alluded to, that there were quite a lot of talk about expelling the Jews. There's obviously the Madagascar plan people talk about. I mean, how credible do you think these ideas were? I mean, had, say, the Nazis won the war, do you think that's what would have happened?
I think if the Nazis had won the war, they would have killed them all. Boy, the way it had gone, the way they were going, I think there's no question that the reason that so many survived was because the war stopped. I mean, that you look at the plan, the general plan for the East of 1942, that there's a plan to kill 20, 30 million Slavs in the eastern areas of their occupation. The Nazis took the view that there was no point in capturing the land if you had people on it, because you wanted to get the food from it. And they were there, they referred to people as useless eaters that they wanted to eliminate. So they're talking about that for the Slavic population, and the epicenter of their hatred was always the Jews. I can't see how they would have wanted one single Jew to survive. So the vision of murder was, and this is astonishing, it seems to me, but the vision was even greater than the horror that they achieved. That's one of the absolutely terrifying things about it.
Can you identify a point where Nazi policy becomes the final solution, that we are going to try and kill all the Jews that we can get our hands on? Or is there never really a defined moment?
I think that you can point to a moment when that policy doesn't exist, say the ghettoization of 1940, and you can point to a moment where it absolutely exists, say the summer of 1943 and the opening of the large new gas chamber crematoria complexes at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And within that period, say 40 to 42, end of 42, beginning of 43, within that period, you can start narrowing down moments or milestones where they're going towards it. And I think absolutely you can do that. And there were a number along the route, the first being the invasion of the Soviet Union and the killing of selected male Jews by the Einsatzgruppen and other security forces. You then see in the autumn of 1941, when Hitler makes the decision that Jews from the Old Reich and the Protectorate will be sent east, and many of them are shot. And then you see the entry of America into the war, which I think is a big thing for Hitler, because it is very much the start of the World War. And he has always prophesied that the extermination of the Jews will follow the World War. And this is the World War. You then have the meeting at Wannsee, which is about, not quite about this, but it's about looking at, it's the first sign we see of them saying 11 million Jews across Europe are at risk. Then the decision, crucial decision in the summer of 1942, where they decide that all the Jews in the, or the vast majority of Jews in an area, massive area of Poland, they've called the general government, are going to be killed. So what you can do if you start to deconstruct it, you can see within that period I mentioned, you can see these milestones along the way. So you can see how they end up with it. To some people, it's counter-suggestible, because what you want, I think when you talk about the most enormous crime there's ever been, if this was a sort of fictional film, you couldn't make the film if you didn't start off with the conspiracy meeting when all the top criminals get together and conspire and say, right, okay, what we're going to do, right, here's what we're going to do, and then implement the crime. So I think in our minds, a lot of people want to try and understand the history that way. It's actually more terrifying, because you can see how once you go down this path, then they're not having to make monumental decisions necessarily in one meeting. They're simply building and building incrementally on a whole series of horrible decisions they're taking. And then they end up somewhere. And in a way, they end up somewhere that they can then go, wow, look, that's where we've ended up. But it's evolved. It's evolved cumulatively through all these key moments.
You mentioned before Auschwitz, which I think for a lot of people is their vision or their understanding of the Holocaust. But do you think that that potentially clouds people's knowledge of the Holocaust? Because it wasn't for most, actually for the majority of Jews, that's not how they ended their lives.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why when I did the original series on this, Nazis Warning from History, nearly 20 years ago, the episode that we made in that series about the extermination program, what I called Road to Treblinka, not Road to Auschwitz, because Auschwitz is an extremely complicated enterprise for lots and lots of different reasons, because it's performing a number of different functions in the Nazi state. It was, even though it ended up being the site of the largest mass murder in the history of the world, that was only one function it provided within the Nazi state. Whereas if you look at a place like Treblinka, that was, and it's very hard to know what adjective to use, because you say it's a pure death camp, it implies there's a purity in it. And of course, there's nothing but a visceral horror in it. Or there's another phrase I tried, dedicated death camp. But that again sounds kind of vaguely positive, doesn't it? It was dedicated. But it was solely created for one purpose. And between, no one knows exactly how many people died there. Maybe 700,000 to 900,000 people died there. 1.1 million in Auschwitz. So very nearly of the same level. And yet, virtually nobody goes to visit the site of Treblinka. And if you did go and visit it, what you would see is very interesting. What you would see is there's nothing there but the monument. And that's because the Nazis destroyed it, because it had done its function by 1943. They'd managed, as they saw it, to win that battle in terms of killing Polish Jews. And within Treblinka, it's really small. That, to me, encapsulates the horror in almost a more emotional way, almost, than a visit to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And that's because you realize that if all you're going to do is to murder people, you need virtually no space, because there's no storage issue. The issue becomes body disposal, and they had a lot of issues with body disposal. But the issue isn't killing them. So you see that 900,000 people, nearly a million people, can die in this tiny area. And it only took a tiny number of SS to organise and supervise it.
Over the course of the Holocaust, actually quite a lot of German people had to be involved. For example, a lot of Jews were shot by an Einsatzgruppen, for example. Do you have any sense, I know you've interviewed some of the perpetrators, do you have any sense of how they could participate in just moments of unbelievable barbarity? Were they coerced into doing this? Were they scared, or did they enjoy it? It's really hard to understand people's motivations.
Yes, and the first thing to say is that enormous numbers of them weren't German. And extraordinary documents in the book from Germans complaining about the barbarity with which the Romanians are killing Jews. Imagine. Oh, the Germans are also complaining about how the Croats are killing people. They're saying, oh, you know, they're talking about the barbarism. So the notion that in any way it's confined to Germans is wrong. In the Baltic states, many, many of the killers were locals. And the one I met, Petras Stulionka, was very much a proud Lithuanian involved in killing people. And he was doing it, I think, like many of them were, for a whole sort of basket of reasons, really. One was obvious anti-Semitism. Another was we underestimate, I think, avarice. I mean, actually, they stole a whole load of stuff from the Jews. Another was a sense, the old trope of the Nazis, that Jews equal communists, which is still, in my travels in Eastern Europe, a number of people say to you, oh, well, yeah, but you've got to understand Marx was a Jew and Judaism is communism, which is nonsense in terms of, you know, we know Stalin was, in some respects, anti-Semitic. And so, nonetheless, there was that equation, Judaism equals communism. There was also a sense, as one very distinguished Lithuanian has analysed this, that they were cleansing themselves with Jewish blood. That's to say, there had been quite a lot of collaboration with the Soviet forces who were in the Baltic states before the Germans came in. And of course, if you'd collaborated with them, one sure way of showing the Germans that in fact you were way above board was to massively go into the enterprise of killing Jews. So you had all of that. Plus you had one other, which I haven't seen that much in the literature there, although there's a lot of new academic work on this. It's really fascinating. But certainly I felt, having met a number of these people, is a big element is straightforward sadism, which is actually they're getting a kick out of this. You know, we see now on the internet, there's all the issues of pornography on the internet, of violent pornography, which is just horrible stuff. Which clearly some people get a kind of kick off. I mean, and actually, there's some deep, dark stuff going on here. And I'd quote a number of examples in the book where we now know that there were people who were really, really enjoying this.
So the bit people probably still find hard to understand is just, you know, where you've got people just seem to be suspending all moral judgment, killing, say, babies, young children. How does someone get to that stage? Because you can't imagine necessarily this happening in a peacetime.
No, I think that's right. I think that you tend to find that genocide happens in war. It's very hard to think of a genocide that isn't within a war and a very violent, bloody war. But I think that you look at Oscar Gröning, who I met and who we interviewed for the Auschwitz series, who worked in Auschwitz. And he talked about how, when we put to him, Frank Stucker, who did the interview with me, was a brilliant researcher who's sadly died now, but was a brilliant researcher who was with me then. And we asked Oscar Gröning, how could, you know, when you thought about the children, what would you think of? And he said, well, the enemy isn't the children. The enemy is the blood in the children that can grow up to be a Jew. So what's happening is the reason that they feel justified, and Himmler himself explicitly says this in a speech in 1943, the reason is because what's the point in killing the adults when you leave the children? Because the children, and Himmler says, they will grow up to be a race of avengers, and then they will come after our children. So in fact, the warped logic is, if you really, really love your own children, then you should kill those children, these other children, because those other children will come after and try and kill your children. So all you've, and if we are brave enough and hard enough now, we have solved the problem for all time, not just for a generation. That's the kind of stuff that's going on in their heads.
Something I find interesting is that even after it's happened, some perpetrators still actually can just feel able to justify it morally. They don't deny their involvement. They actually quite openly say that they were involved, and they people at the time and later on could find a moral justification for their acts.
Yes. I mean, that was one of the reasons that I've carried on with this for 25 years, because I was always driven by my own, in TV history, by my own curiosity and interests. And if I ever felt that I got to the bottom of something, I never felt I wanted to stick with it. I wanted to do something else. And the reason I'm still with this so many years on is because you dig and dig and dig and you can't get to the bottom of it. And one of the reasons you can't is because you don't expect the response you get. And if you talk to, for example, former members of the NKVD, the Stalin secret police who were involved in the horrendous deportation, say, of the Kalmyks or the Chechens or the Crimean Tatars, you talk to people involved in those terrible deportations, which were really vile. And for the most part, what they'll say is, well, if I didn't do it, I'd be shot. And of course, it's very little, it's very, very hard to go somewhere in an interview. If you say to someone, why did you do it? And they said, well, it's dead easy. You know, I felt I had a gun to my head and I wanted, you know. Now, that may or may not be so, but certainly in terms of their own way of dealing with it and talking to you about it, that's what they say. What was extraordinary about all these former Nazis is I don't think I ever heard that. I don't think we ever heard that in all the years we were doing. I don't think we did. What you tended to hear was, at the time we felt it was the right thing to do, there was an internalization of belief. And it's that that makes this terrifying and also endlessly fascinating.
And it kind of makes Holocaust denial even more ridiculous when the perpetrators themselves
yes.
don't deny it.
Yes. Well, one of the extraordinary things about Oskar Gröning is the reason he gave us that an interview on camera was because he was really upset at his stamp collecting club when he came across a Holocaust denier. And he said, I was there. It's almost like it was an attempt to deny that he had done his job. He said, I was there. Don't tell me it didn't happen. I was there. So he spoke out because he was against Holocaust denial. Quite extraordinary.
So obviously you've talked about some nations, people collaborated with the Nazis, but in terms of the other powers around the world, could they have done more to prevent the Holocaust? Obviously they weren't the perpetrators, but are they in some way culpable too?
Well, I think you've got to separate the two questions in a way. Could they have done more? Yeah, of course, you can always do more. Are they culpable? Implying kind of, can you blame them? It's very hard. I always have these discussions with with academic historians because I get emotionally, there's a certain level of emotional engagement when you're meeting people who suffered terribly and these sorts of things. And of course, there's an argument which is the job of the historian is to be kind of like, sort of objectively above it and never pass judgment because you're trying to understand and not judge and so on. And so when you say, well, are they culpable? You know, it's hard to say, but certainly there's certainly more could be done. If you look at the 1938 Evian conference, where there's a conference about what to do about the fact that the Jews are being persecuted in Germany and Austria. And I don't think there's any doubt that if the West had said, we'll take them, Hitler would have said, great, have them. Where I do have a judgment about this is what was plain, and the World Jewish Congress said this at the time, was unless you look at the possibilities of Palestine as a home for the Jews, there's virtually no way this can be solved. And the British were running a mandate in Palestine. And at that point, the British refused to discuss it for all sorts of other reasons that they felt were good reasons. But nonetheless, if there had been a move to open the gates of Palestine, or Israel as it then became, well, split between Israel and Palestine, but nonetheless, complex history of that region. But nonetheless, if there'd been a move to accept large numbers of Jews at that point, then I think that would have been an extraordinarily valuable thing to do. Now, but that easy for me to say and easy for anyone to say with hindsight and so on. But nonetheless, there were a number of people who knew this at the time, that there was no possibility of individual countries accepting very, very large numbers of Jews who needed to come and needed to be taken away from that horror. But the possibility of Palestine, especially in the light of the Balfour Declaration of the First World War from the British, especially in the light of that, it was really sad in retrospect that something wasn't done along those lines.
I suppose on a related note, one thing that's very interesting in the book is you note how the Jews in different occupied countries fared in the Holocaust and how some, such as Greeks, very high percentage, or Hungarians, very high percentage were taken to Auschwitz or other camps and killed, whereas in other countries such as Denmark, quite a low number of Jews were killed. How do you think that? Why do you think there was such a difference between the different countries under occupation?
Again, that's a huge, huge question, because it depends on a number of variables. But what you see is that how the Nazis are trying to impose what they call their final solution varies from place to place, depending on a whole range of different factors. So it isn't the case to say that if you were a Jew in occupied Nazi territory, you're necessarily going to be killed. And that's because if you're a Danish Jew, the vast majority, more than 95%, didn't experience persecution and didn't experience certainly the kind of persecution that happened elsewhere and escaped. Most of them across the sea to Sweden. But if you were a Greek Jew in Salonika, massive chance that you would be killed. So the Nazis are operating a different level of, it's hard to say desire, because they have the same level of desire, but there's a whole series of practical matters that influence them, such that the picture is not at all uniform. It's extremely complicated, depending on all these different factors, not least the nature of the occupying forces, the nature of the Jews in the country, what proportion of Jews, for example, are foreign. You find this with the French, that they take the Vichy French take a completely different view of this, depending on whether you're a, quote, French Jew or a foreign Jew. So you see that large numbers of immigrants coming into the country, they're the ones who the French almost want to kind of deal with in some way first.
This story, it's incredibly bleak throughout, but there are a few examples of actual heroism among people in some of these occupied countries who did their best to save Jews. What do you think it was that made these people stand up and take often personal risk for no obvious gain to themselves?
Again, I think there's a number of different factors. One is culture. That's to say, if you look in Denmark, there was a belief that, I think, that you're a Dane first and a Jew or a Christian or a whatever second. But there was a cohesion of culture whereby there were Danish values about what we do. And that seemed to mean that when the moment came to try and protect people, they were absolutely willing to try and do it. But then you look at it, what's fascinating is the Netherlands, because There was a very little tradition of anti-Semitism in the Netherlands, and yet more than 70% of Dutch Jews were killed. And so you can't ever... The thing about this subject is once you think you've come up with a one catch-all explanation, something else appears that shows that's not so. So what's extraordinary is you find that a country that doesn't have much anti-Semitism in it, nonetheless, enormous numbers of Jews are murdered. And there, partly, it might be that there's a sense that, well, we're in a country where there isn't anti-Semitism, so we're relatively safe. And there's a sense of, well, this can't really be happening, can it? So when the Dutch civil servants, who cooperated massively with the Nazis, do so, I don't think they think they're doing it thinking this is going to end with murder of enormous numbers of people. I think they do it thinking, well, you know, there's a certain bureaucracy and a certain legal system and so on. So you see that within any of these societies, there are people who a minority who stand up and say this is wrong. And you see in many cases, it doesn't actually help necessarily in practical terms. What it offers is a moral statement of what's happening. And then you see in other environments where people have been educated and brought up to be viciously anti-Semitic, there's a sense of, well, what's happening broadly might be the right thing, not necessarily the killing, but certainly the deportations.
You've raised the point there of how much did people actually know of what was going on in the Holocaust? I mean, to what extent did people outside of the death camps, outside the killing zones, what sense were they aware of where the Jews were being sent? Were they all being sent to their death?
It's grey, essentially. It's grey. It's not a black and white. There's levels of grey of knowledge. If you're looking at, if you're saying, well, did the vast majority of people, say in Germany, know about what was happening in Treblinka or Auschwitz? No. Did they know something bad's happening to Jews in the East? Yes. The reason they knew something bad's happening to Jews in the East is, number one, they've seen them being put on trains, they'd been taken out, marched through the town and taken away somewhere. Where do they think they're going? They're not going somewhere better. Given the rhetoric of the regime, the idea that anybody in their right minds could possibly think these people had been taken somewhere better than where they are. Wherever it is, it's got to be somewhere bad. It's worse than where we are. So they know that. Everybody knows that. Secondly, they've been listening to this rhetoric from Adolf Hitler. He's completely open. He's talking about if there is a world war, there will be an extermination of the Jews. His speeches are full of absolute vitriol about the Jews, about the danger of the Jews, how they're the wire pullers. And so, I mean, you know, it's clear what the head of your government feels about these people. So they've been taken away, something bad's happening, and our head of state is going on and on and on about something bad here. So of course, there's a knowledge, it must be, that something bad's going on. They then start hearing from, you know, pretty much in any street, there'll be a number of people who've got husbands or sons or brothers or whatever fighting in the East. Anyone who is fighting in the war in the East is aware that this is a war of extermination, that it's a different kind of war, and very probably that there is targeting of civilians and Jewish civilians in particular in ways that are absolutely horrific. Well, they're going to come home. They come home on leave. They're not going to keep quiet about this. So the idea that something bad, something really bad is happening in the East, I think it has to be prevalent. And you see that in a number of reports from the time, because the Nazis are also doing reports about the mood of the public. And there's one, I think it's from Southern Germany in the end of the 1942, that says there is major disquiet amongst the population about rumors of shootings and killings of Jews in the East. And then it says something really interesting. And it says the disquiet, and I'm paraphrasing, but the disquiet is, if we lose the war, what will happen to us? It's really fascinating. It isn't that there's a sense or necessarily of outrage at the inhumanity of this. We must get up and stop it happening. It's a sense of, oh my God, what are they going to do to us if we lose?
One force that you might have expected to prevent or at least lessen the Holocaust would be Christianity, I guess the Vatican. And also Europe at the time was had far more strong Christian beliefs than they do nowadays. But this didn't seem to have that much effect. Why do you think it was that Christianity and Christian belief didn't do more to stop people participating in something that's clearly against any kind of religion?
Well, I think, you know, and in the book, I'm very critical of the Pope at the time for not speaking out. And it's important to try and understand why he doesn't. A number of churchmen do, of course. There's a number of individual churchmen who do speak out, notably Bishop von Galen, who speaks out about the dreadful euthanasia action against the mentally and physically disabled. So there are isolated incidents where you can absolutely say individual churchmen did have a moral sense. Overall, though, you can't say that the church, certainly the Catholic Church, comes out of this well. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is certainly what the Pope seems to be concerned about is communism. He's deeply, deeply anti-communist, frightened of communism because it's absolute godless Bolshevism. Secondly, I think he's weak. And he's weak in the sense that he believes that if I speak out, something worse might happen all the time. Well, of course, that's a reason in any situation to do nothing. And I think also he doesn't speak out because he has this sense that his role is to protect the institutions of the church. And there's always a risk, he feels, I think, that the Germans might occupy the Vatican. They're certainly from autumn of 1943 until the summer of 1944, there's German troops immediately outside in Rome. So he's anxious that the Vatican might be invaded, the Vatican might even be bombed by the Germans, that churches might be overrun and so on and so forth. So there's always reasons not to do anything. But also underlying it, I think, there's surely, in certain aspects, not with the individual Pope, I think, but you look at Slovakia. Slovakia is a really, really interesting case because the president of Slovakia, Jozef Tiso, is a Catholic priest. He's a Catholic priest, and he is presiding over the deportation of Jews. And yet, even when he's tried after the war and executed for war crimes, he's sitting in his cell in his full priest's garb. He's not excommunicated. Now, that is, it seems to me, is absolutely terrifying and very hard to see how the church comes well out of this, because this is after the war and there's still no move made against him. And he goes to his death as a Catholic priest, having been responsible for some truly horrific things during the war.
There were cases where Jews themselves became part of the apparatus of the Holocaust. Clearly, they were under very different circumstances than non-Jews taking part. But and I'm sure, I know you've spoken to some of the people, the Sonic Commando, for example, and there were also Jewish councils in the ghettos. How did they manage to kind of square the moral complexities of what they were doing?
Some of the most extraordinary people I've ever met in my life are former Sonderkommandos. And the Sonderkommando is somebody who was forced, on pain of their own immediate death, to assist the Germans in the running of the exterminationary machinery. So, for example, if you remember the Sonderkommando, you could be involved in disentangling the bodies in the gas chambers after people have been murdered, in cleaning the gas chambers, in sorting all the belongings of the Jews, in burying the bodies, in carrying the bodies around, and so on. So you were doing stuff really of absolute nightmare. And there were a number of cases, some of these under commandos said to me, where the Jews, they were, say, shaving their hair before they in a camp like Sobibor. If you were a woman, you would have your hair shaved before you went into the gas chamber, because the Nazis wanted to use the hair for they made felt and stuff out of it and other industrial processes. And you're doing this, and it might be that one of these women you're saying, whose hair you're shaving, says, "Why are you doing this? Are you doing this just to save your own life?" Because they suspected what was going to happen to them. And to a large extent, these under commander could be traumatized by that. But what else are they going to do? What else are they going to do? It's like, of all the moral dilemmas you're ever going to face, it's one of the absolute toughest. And I would never ever judge anyone in that situation. I mean, it would be absolutely disgusting to judge somebody in that situation, because what are they going to do? What are you going to do? But nonetheless, it was an absolutely horrendous situation. I always remember probably the most extraordinary person I've ever met in my life is a man called, now dead, called Toivy Blatt, who was a Sonderkommando at Sobibor death camp. And I asked him what he'd learned from the experience of being a Sonderkommando there. And he said, "I've learned this. Nobody knows themselves, because it's not until you're placed in a situation like that that you know what you're capable of and who you are." And he said, "You see these people walking down the street and they ask you for directions, or you ask them for directions and they say, down here and turn right or whatever." And he said, "I always look at them and just think, you know, you seem a nice guy, but what would you be like in Sobibor? Because you simply don't know." It's actually something a former member of the SS once said to me, which was, the trouble with the world today is people who've never been tested go around making judgments about people who have been tested. And whilst that didn't alter me thinking what he did was disgusting and disgraceful, nonetheless, it makes you think. And so there is extraordinary stories from the Sonderkommando, quite extraordinary. I put them in a different category altogether than I do a man like Mordecai Chaim Ronkowski, who was the guy who was the chairman of the council in the Lodz ghetto, who absolutely plainly used his authority within the ghetto for his own personal ends. I mean, I've met a woman who was sexually abused by him, for example. I mean, he absolutely gratified himself. To me, that's a whole different matter. And I do think, though you can understand, again, that all these people are placed in situations deliberately by the Nazis in order to make their situations impossible, it doesn't mean that you have to sexually abuse people.
Did you find yourself going through the book at various points thinking what you might have done in these circumstances
too? I think it's inevitable that you do, but what I've learned is you simply can't know. And the reason you can't know is because I tried to explain this once, and I came up with the idea that I was giving this talk in, I don't know, was it school or somewhere? And I said, imagine that all the doors are now locked and we have to stay in here for 24 hours and there's no water, nothing. We're just sitting here locked in here. We've got to go to the toilet in the corner or do whatever, but we're not allowed out of this room for 24 hours now. And then tomorrow, there's maybe 100 of us, someone comes in with a 1-liter bottle of water. What are you going to do to get some of that water? How are you going to decide who gets that water? And you know that there's not going to be any more water for another day, and then there's going to be another 1 litre bottle of water. What are you going to do? And I don't think sitting here, we can know what we're going to do. I don't think you know whether you'll be the person who goes, no, there's somebody there sick. They should have some water. Or are you going to fight for it? Are you going to try and hurt other people to get it? Or are you going to say, no, please, do you know what you do in that situation now? If you don't know what you do in that situation now, how can you possibly even begin to guess what you would do were something similar to this happen again? And then on top of that, you've got the fact that were you then, you wouldn't be you because you're only you because of the whole cultural upbringing you've had in this society. So you can't transpose yourself back then because you wouldn't be you anyway. But if you ask, well, what would I do if something similar was to happen? As I say, even then you can't know because I think we all have these wonderful ideas about ourselves until we're actually tested. And then maybe we turn out to be better people than we think we are, or maybe we turn out to be a lot worse.
So far, we've been talking mainly about the Jewish victims, but they're also, as the book shows, people, Sinti and Roma, for example, were killed in large numbers. There were various physically, mentally disabled people killed and homosexuals. Do you see that as part of the Holocaust? Do you see that as separate crimes?
How I look at it is that what we call the Holocaust is the decision and implementation of measures to exterminate the Jews. But you cannot possibly understand that unless you include all these other things, because the Nazis don't use the word Holocaust. You talk about the final solution of the Jewish problem, but they have a horrendously, deeply racial mindset that encompasses lots of different things, of which the epicenter is hatred of the Jews. So you can't write about this or make a film about it, in my view, without looking at the penumbra, without looking at, well, if I'm trying to understand motivations, what kind of people are they? And profoundly, they're racist people. But what other beliefs around that do you imagine? So absolutely, I think that it's important to look at all these other issues as well, if only to see how the Nazis themselves differentiated their belief system between them all.
The Holocaust clearly wasn't the only genocide that's happened, even sadly, in the 20th century. Do you think that it is still a magnitude greater, or is it still the worst crime in human history?
The reason I would say it was is partly to prevent it being perceived as just another bit of history, if you like. To me, it's different. Why is it different? It's different because it happened relatively recently ago. And I think that impacts on me because I've met so many people who were affected from it. And there's a sense of history when you can actually meet and talk to people that makes it a different kind of history than talking, say, about Genghis Khan. But also it's because, and I always think of a very much valued relationship I had with Professor David Cesarani, who helped me on my Auschwitz series as a consultant and who sadly died last year. But I always thought he was a great intellectual. And in conversation with me, I asked him that same question, and he said, well, I don't think in human history there's been a case where an individual leader has decided that one ethnic religious group will be exterminated down to the last baby, and we will create in a short period of time mechanistic means to be able to do and achieve this. And I do think that is different. I'm not sure that that's been attempted in quite that way before. Hitler pointed, for example, to what was happening in America with the death of the Native Americans. Well, it was horrendous what happened, of course, in North America, but nonetheless, Native Americans survived. There's still Native Americans around. You look at certain areas of Europe and there are no Jews. There's no question in my view that had the war not stopped and had he carried on, you would have a situation in Europe where there was not one. Not one. And that is if you think of it, that is a truly extraordinary thing. When I did a series about Stalin, I always remember in Ukraine, I was interviewing, we were interviewing this guy who's a member of the Ukrainian resistance movement. And at the end of the war, he'd been sentenced, I think, to 20 years in a gulag. And he'd come back and he was now a grandfather with his children around. And he said they did it. And I was thinking, isn't that interesting? You know, Stalin, unspeakable monster that he was, didn't kill him. And now, and in fact, it was really horrible because I thought of Himmler's quote about children when I saw this family, this guy's family. And there's a breadth of nihilistic, horrible, brutal vision to this that wasn't there with Stalin. And that nihilistic, brutal vision was, this is our job, this generation, to sort this. And if we do it, it's over forever. And I don't know I've seen that anywhere else.
And this is slightly beyond the scope of your book, but do you believe that the perpetrators of the Holocaust who survived the war were sufficiently brought to book afterwards?
No, absolutely not. No, absolutely not. The vast majority of SS who worked at Auschwitz got off scot-free. Absolutely not. There was a sense, I mean, one of the terrible, terrible things about it was that after the war, I think there was a view taken that if you weren't personally involved in killing somebody, then you weren't going to be charged. And of course, because they developed gas chambers, which needed a tiny number of Germans and a large number of Sonderkommando, but a tiny number of Germans to operate them, the vast majority of SS at Auschwitz, you could say, well, I wouldn't personally be involved in the killing. And the answer to which ought to be, of course you were, because you were involved in the process. And in fact, what's interesting about the case of Oskar Gröning, who we interviewed for the Auschwitz series, and who then, just last year, the year before, was actually finally put on trial when he's a very, very old man now. And that was because only in the last few years had they changed the law in Germany, or the law had evolved to a place where the position I've just had is the position they hold. But they didn't hold it in the late 1940s and 50s. Otherwise, enormous numbers of people, more people, would have been brought to book.
Do you think that had something to do with the political realities of post-World War II Europe?
It had there's lots and lots and lots of reasons for it. One is exactly that, the political realities of post-war Europe, that actually there was a very strong sense in which we've got to move on. There was a sense of the new enemy is very clear. It's the Soviet bloc. What good in West Germany does it do to try and dismantle all of the various apparatuses of local government and government by start going, well, hang on, what exactly did you do under the Nazis? What exactly? You know, there was a real movement for saying, we've dealt with the people at the very top. Okay, the Nuremberg trials, let's, you know, kind of move on. And you can see and understand, I suppose, why that happened. There was also all of the sense we have of the importance of the Holocaust wasn't there then so much. The very word Holocaust didn't come into the public consciousness really, really sort of in a major, major way until the 70s. There wasn't. People think Holocaust Memorial Day has been with us since the war. It hasn't. It's only been with us for the last, I don't know, 10 years or so. The sense back then was very, very, very different.
Just finally, are there any lessons from this book in terms of how the world could try to prevent something of this magnitude happening again?
Well, I never say there are lessons from history, because I don't think there can be lessons from history, because lessons implies that you can take a rubric, you can say, well, this happened this way, so now this will happen. And I don't think you can do that with history. But I did call the original series years and years and years ago Warning from History, because I do think history offers us some broad warnings. And I think there's a number that you can perhaps think about with this. The first is this sense that things happen incrementally or can happen incrementally, that once you allow a state to happen that's racist, that you educate children to believe you're better than they are, and the other people are not really proper human beings. That's something, that's a real warning. It doesn't mean it's necessarily going to lead to this. Very often it probably won't. But nonetheless, I would say it's almost a necessary precondition of some of this motivation that was going on there. Another big one is to think that something that's a minority, a tiny minority of what look like loonies, with catastrophic economic change, people can turn to them. The Nazis got 2.6% of the vote in 1928. Less than 5 years later, Hitler is at the head of the most popular party in Germany and is chancellor. He was dismissed. Plenty of people in 1928 thought they're a lunatic fringe. Well, what do we think is a lunatic fringe now? Where can it be in 5 years? You don't know. I mean, that things change. And what changed was not him. There's this notion of, oh, it's amazing, a charismatic leader and so on. And I've made a special study of charisma because it's interesting to me what charismatic leadership's about. And what you see is what charismatic leadership is primarily about is a connection with people. And the connection is only possible if the people you're trying to connect with have a need for you. So in 1928, a lot of people think this guy's a jerk because there's no need. You have a massive economic catastrophe where all the institutions that you've trusted, all of the respectable politicians, if you like, have let you down. And then actually someone who isn't a respectable politician, someone who actually is way left field, you begin to say, do you know, we need a massive change. And I did think this guy was a bit of a loony, but actually the more you look at what's happening now, I mean, a change, you know, can't be all bad to have change. And you can see almost how swiftly that can happen once you get banks collapsing, mass unemployment. I once said to a former Nazi, I said, you know, he was the most unconventional politician you're ever going to come across. And the guy said to me, yeah, and they were the most unconventional times you can imagine. So exactly. So I think that there are all those sorts of things that you can look at and think about. And also what happens when you don't do things early enough, when you let things kind of drift, or you start doing what Neville Chamberlain starts doing in 1938, which is not understand what you're dealing with or project onto people that, oh, they can't seriously mean that, can they? I mean, you look at what he's saying. He's not, this is what's extraordinary about the whole thing. If you read Mein Kampf, he's talking about the Jews are the most horrific problem that have to be dealt with, and Germany needs space, and the only way of getting space is the western section of the Soviet Union. I mean, he says it's quite extraordinary. If it was a novel you were writing, it would not be credible, and it wouldn't be credible because you would think, oh no, the lead character here, they must hide stuff. They must have some. They mustn't actually say it, but he does.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That was Lawrence Rees. The Holocaust, A New History is set to be published by Viking on the 26th of January. And you can read a version of this interview in the January edition of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Also in this month's issue, we have articles on the Anglo-Saxons' final battles, the history of Sicily, the Stauffenberg plot, and Elizabeth I's Irish nemesis, among other things. You can get hold of our January issue in all good newsagents in the UK and in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier print edition that's currently in the shops. Well, that's about it for this week, but please do join us next time for more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. And for more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com. It's packed with articles, quizzes, image galleries, and much more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.